How much privacy would you trade for better health and a longer life? How will this century be shaped by big data, genomics, and the artificial intelligence that makes sense of it all? Welcome to Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead, a former foreign correspondent, long based in China, now in San Francisco. So, on big data and health, you've got your Fitbits and Apple Watches and assorted gadgets that keep track of how and what you're doing, how far you're walking or running, and how fast and at what heart rate. You can track how well you sleep, how much you fidget, whether you slouch, your blood pressure, your glucose levels, all kinds of things. And you can take it to the next level. Companies like 23andMe will sequence your genome. You can see what risk factors you have for disease. Perhaps you don't want to know. Perhaps, if you do have elevated risk factors, you can take steps to reduce the risk. After all, genes only go so far in determining what happens to you. Your lifestyle choices, how much you sleep and exercise, what you eat, can have profound effects on how some genes are expressed. So can your gut bacteria. All of this is fascinating to scientists and promising for a global population that's living longer. Now, there's a China connection here. In southern China, in the city of Shenzhen, right next to Hong Kong, is a company called BGI, originally Beijing Genomics Institute, that is the world's leading sequencer of genomes, human, animal, plant. It's also got big ambitions to be a global leader in life sciences research. It's already working with top research institutes around the world and has published in world-class journals. BGI's work hasn't been without controversy. One of its many focuses has been on finding the genetic basis for genius, raising concerns in some quarters about a future of designer babies. But that's one small part of what BGI does. This autumn, BGI hosted a conference that drew hundreds of geneticists and other researchers from leading institutions around the globe. One of the focuses was the promise of precision medicine. Medicine based on your genome, on your genotype and phenotype, based on collecting lots of data over time.
So I'm thinking about different scenarios, how to integrate like lifestyle data into the systems through internet, how to make the diets integrated into the systems, how to make the biosensors work, like non-invasive glucose level detectors, things like that.
This is Wang Jun at that conference. He was, until this past summer, the chief executive of BGI. He's charismatic, relatively young, around 40. The journal Nature has called him visionary and revered and credited him and his drive for much of what has led BGI to become a global player. Now, Wang Jun is starting his own venture called iCarbonX. I is for Internet, X for X Factor, for what's yet to be discovered, and carbon?
But we are carbon-based. We are basically a program, right? And DNA is just a form of programs.
So why not use ever more sophisticated technologies and computers and big data to better understand the code of life?
People are talking about singularity, right? People are talking about computing power is there. So the computing power is more and more powerful than the human brain, which I don't really believe, but, you know, it's coming.
The singularity, that's a concept that comes out of San Francisco and the Bay Area. There's even a Singularity University here. The singularity is the idea that technology will eventually create greater than human intelligence with the same range and subtlety of human intelligence. Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla, once warned that advancing artificial intelligence was summoning the demons. But now he's investing in research to drive it in the right direction, in a direction that will help and not hurt humans. President Obama was also trying to move in the right direction when he announced early this year a national project to sequence 1 million genomes. This, too, is to move toward precision medicine. Wang Jun says, 1 million genomes, great. Why stop there?
It was a million genomics project we are talking about, right? To sequence 1 million individuals' genome. I don't think that's the right goal. We have to collect 1 million omics data for the same individual.
Omics, that's a layer of information about life, about biology. Genomics is one of them.
Not mentioning sequencing a genome, 1 million individuals level, but we are talking about DNA, RNA, protein, metabolites, environment, social graph, like, you know, behavior data, biosensors, imaging data, very high quality clinical data information there. Now talking about the volume of the data, how you can get those users, right? How can you sort of guarantee the data quality? After you have all those data, how you going to analysis the data? How you can get the money to get the data? There's a lot of questions there. So this is good, because then I know not many people could achieve that. So that leaves me opportunity, which I think I should jump in to the next field.
And as he jumps in, he intends to make a splash. Wang Jun says starting next year, his new company aims to sequence people's genomes for free.
The reason is simple. The value of the genome right now to a person, to an ordinary person like you, that's not worth $100 now. Well, maybe you don't really agree with me, but how many people wants to pay $100 to get your genome sequenced if you are not a researcher like me? But I strongly believe after accumulated 1 million genomes there, the value of that is more than $10,000, $1 million to you.
The promise of combining big data about genomics is that we'll start to understand patterns in a large population, what combinations of genes and behavior and environment over time lead to certain outcomes. This could save lives, it could extend lives, it could improve the quality of life for millions of people, maybe for billions. But what about you, the patient, sitting there in the doctor's office wanting to know what your genome tells you about what to do about your health and your life right now? That's still a work in progress. Someone who spoke about this at the conference was Ketan Puranjapi, Intel's General Manager of Life Sciences and Analytics.
When you do sequencing today, when you talk about precision medicine from a genome sequencing perspective, you start with your traditional sequencers 1 to 4 days. The analysis takes about a few weeks, depending on what tools you use, what technologies you use. And finally, you get into the mode of actually finding clinically actionable components that you can make a treatment decision on. Right? That is basically the key problem. This takes forever, as we all know it. Again, you know, we talk about precision medicine. To a lot of countries, emerging economies, where they still use the fax. So imagine what sort of networking systems do they have in their country so you even move the data from one place to the other. So what's our vision? Back to Dr. Wong's point, if he can give us a free sequence in the morning, can we get a clinically actionable thing for his gout, for example, by the end of the day, by 2020? Is that possible?
Perhaps, but with the speed of sequencing and processing and analyzing, the range of new techniques and how to use genomes, comes a host of ethical questions. A group of international scientists met in Washington in early December and called for a moratorium on editing the human genome with a technique just 3 years old called CRISPR. This technique allows scientists to fairly easily and quickly delete, replace, or change DNA. And these changes can be passed on to the next generation. The one experiment done thus far on humans, on non-viable human embryos, was in southern China at Sun Yat-sen University, and this was a cautionary tale. The researchers used CRISPR on 85 different embryos, trying to remove just one gene without affecting others, and they failed in each case. Wired magazine put the quandary pretty well in a tagline on a recent article on CRISPR. It said, "We now have the power to quickly and easily alter DNA. It could eliminate disease. It could solve world hunger. It could provide unlimited clean energy. It could really get out of hand." Wang Jun agrees. He says it's prudent to go slowly when it comes to editing the human genome.
So, of course, people are also talking about how to change or rebuild the whole life information, right? Which I think is too dangerous for a species like a human. We don't even understand human as a system yet. Don't try to just change it from base pairs level. But maybe we could start it with bacteria, you know, or even yeast or whatever, but probably it's still too early to thinking about human.
And then there's the question of privacy. In this brave new world of combining genomics and big data, how much privacy do you give up, and to whom, and for whose benefit? For the pharma companies to profit from your information? Do you get anything back from that? Do you lose anything when so many more people know the essence of what physiologically makes you, you?
Because clearly we're moving to an age where a huge amount of personal information, personal medical information, personal genomic information, personal healthcare information, clinical information, brain scans and clinical histories, is increasingly available online in massive networked databases. And this is the whole hope of precision medicine, to develop algorithms that can mine that and identify clinically meaningful patterns.
Nicholas Rose heads the Department of Social Science, Health and Medicine at King's College in London. He led a session at the BGI conference on ethics in an age of genomics and big data, and he especially focused on privacy. Interestingly, the attitude of several presenters at the conference seemed to be, sharing is good, get it all out there. They put their own medical and genomic data up on PowerPoint slides. Hundreds of people were in the audience. Some took notes. Some took photos on their mobile phones. As an American, I reflexively cringed. Even with the Affordable Care Act preventing insurance companies from denying insurance to people with pre-existing conditions, there are still ways such data could be used in ways detrimental to the patient. And that's not even going into stigma attached to certain conditions or genetic predispositions. I mean, if your genome says you have a high risk of getting cancer or Alzheimer's or becoming an alcoholic, how widely would you want to share that information? With a prospective employer? With someone you're dating? How would your family members feel if you were sharing that data? After all, they might have some of the same genes. At the BGI conference, there seemed to be few such qualms. Here's Wang Jun, who was showing his own genomic and biomedical data in a PowerPoint presentation.
So I did my personal genetic testing many times, actually, through Illumina Complete Genomics Technology, using my research grants, which is great because I get it for free. So I probably have one of the most accurate genome in the world. So I sort of look at it many, many times, try to also get it faced and whatever. Then I start to look at my own genome, right? Fortunately, I don't have any monogenic disorders there. As you could see, I'm still functional. So it's okay. But then I also find out I have several problems there. I'm a carrier, which actually have a pretty much a very bad, if you look at the uric acid level, so it's pretty bad. I have a level of 900. So normally the boundary is about 460 or something, but I have 900 there. I don't feel anything, okay? I don't feel any pain or anything. I eat a lot of seafood, drink beers, so I don't really feel it's a problem. But I do it do show as a trace, right? So I do show my uric acid level is quite high.
So he started doing a little research in traditional Chinese medicine books, found that changing gut bacteria could make a difference and that burdock root tea can do it. It can lower uric acid levels and prevent gout. He started drinking it. His uric acid levels went down. Success. Wang Jun also talked about some of his genetic risk factors, like a gene he and apparently half the Chinese population carry for a disease that can be potentially deadly. He points to this as an example of why it's important to pool data, to better understand how such genes are expressed in a wider population. If millions of people have the same genetic risk and only some get sick, what made the difference? What could others learn from that? Nicholas Rose says there is a compelling argument for sharing data under the right conditions.
Now, my personal view, and it's certainly not any official view, my personal view is that the conventional means that we've used to protect data, consent to go into clinical trials, confidentiality by technological means, are simply insufficient. Even if we wanted to keep them there, they're simply insufficient to cope with how data is used in this massively networked age. You cannot give meaningful consent to every future use of your data because you've absolutely no idea what that is. You cannot guarantee anonymity, because what we now realize is that even the most technologically advanced means for ensuring anonymity, stripping off your personal identifiers, can be cracked with one or two identifiers left. And with the oncoming development of quantum computing, it looks as if, at least the experts assure me, that quantum computing can defeat any existing technological measure to preserve anonymity. So my view is that we need to go to the other end of this, not to try and preserve privacy, anonymity, etc., etc., etc. in the ways that we have conventionally, but to act against what might be the misuses of that data. So act against genetic discrimination, act against stigma, act against all those misuses, but allow the data to flow as freely as it can, because in reality we're not able to control it. So we reassure ourselves by having data protection regulation and so on. It's a big issue in Europe at the moment as new data protection legislation is going through the European Parliament. Everybody was horrified by Edward Snowden's revelations of the NSA looking at all your personal data. But we willingly give our data up to Google, to Apple, and to all these other organisations. And I think there's a kind of paradox there. So I think we need to think about protections in the world that is to come, or is already coming, when you mix network genomic data with cloud-based systems, with algorithmic means to interrogate that data for the purposes of precision medicine. We need to think about the protections that we need in this new world, rather than thinking that the old protections are going to do their job, because to my mind they will not be able to do the job.
Just thinking off the top of my head, there are at least three levels, four, that I can think of that would need to change. You know, one is regulations or curbs on government use of people's private bio data in ways that are discriminatory or that put that person at a disadvantage. The second is, not so much in England, but in the United States, health insurance companies saying, oh, you have this cancer gene, yeah, then we're going to triple your insurance. The third is stigma. The third is, you know, if people know that you are likely to get Alzheimer's when you're in your 60s, or that you carry some other gene that's likely to kick in at a time when, like, let's say an employer is like, oh, you're too big a risk, I'm not going to hire you. And then, of course, on top of all of that, there are, you know, malevolent hackers who might take your data and throw it out somewhere where you don't want it to be. Those are huge things to change. What do you see that could happen realistically to keep up with the changes in what's happening in the field?
Right. I think those are the four key areas where, you know, there are challenging issues. The first about use of data to discriminate against you. I think the US is actually quite a good example in its Genetic Non-Discrimination Act in making discrimination on the grounds of genetic information illegal. And I would argue that that act should be extended not only to genetic information, but to neurobiological information. Because, of course, as we've heard here in Shenzhen, it's not just genetic information that's going up online. It's clinical information and it's brain scan information and other scanning information, imaging information that's being digitized and going up online. So I think that non-discrimination acts can be very, very useful here. I think also one should make it illegal for insurance companies or for employers to discriminate on the grounds of these kinds of information. Now, actually, it's not clear whether insurance companies in the main need this information. At least historically, they've always argued when I've been in discussion with them that they have enough information from knowing what your parents died from to make predictions as to whether or not you're likely to contract those diseases. They've made exceptions for certain conditions like HIV and so on. But I think there are ways of framing legislation to deal with those questions of discrimination. As for wider questions of stigma, I think it's very difficult to know how one handles those. Those questions of stigma, stigma on grounds of mental health, stigma on the grounds of maybe sexually contracted diseases and things like that already exist in our society. I don't myself think that this genomic or other healthcare information is going to make that any worse, and I think probably one should tackle that stigma in other ways. As for the malevolent hackers, they are there. We know they're there. We've seen them there getting into our bank accounts. We've seen them there stealing all our personal information from the companies that we trade with on the web and things like that. I don't think that this is going to make that situation any worse. I think we just have to continually upgrade our anti-hacking software in order to protect ourselves against those risks. But I think we're in a world that we can't go back on this world. There's a term in technology development called path dependency. Once you're down a certain path, it's impossible to go back. 20 years ago, perhaps, we should have said, oh, the internet, it's going to raise all these problems 20 years down the line when all our personal information is going to be out there. Let's not have the internet. But that's an impossible thing to uninvent once we're there. So we're in this world. There's nothing we can do to prevent the path that we've gone down. So we have to try and find realistic measures, as I say, to deal with the abuses, but not pretend that we cannot be where we are.
And here we are, in a world with ever faster, cheaper ways of sequencing genomes, monitoring biometrics, pooling and analyzing data, editing genes. These are tools. Tools can be used in all kinds of ways. It's good that there's an active conversation going on among scientists, a willingness to tap the brakes and think, really think, about where certain roads might lead. Jennifer Doudna is a biochemist and one of the discoverers of the gene editing technique CRISPR. She told The New Yorker that she lies awake some nights and wonders if CRISPR will eventually do more harm than good. She said she once dreamt that she met Hitler, who asked her for more details on the uses and implications of what he called this amazing technology. When it comes to understanding and harnessing all these new techniques and technology to understand life, the code of life, genomics, and how to alter and influence it, this will be a transformative century. But transformed how? In some ways, in important ways, that's up to us to shape it and steer it as we go. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me, Mary Kay Magstead, and PRI's The World, in partnership with the BBC and WGBH. It's made possible by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. If you like what you've heard, subscribe on iTunes. You can also listen on SoundCloud or Stitcher, or go to our webpage, pri.org/century, where you'll find more on this episode and others. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstead, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. And if you've got ideas, comments, reactions, send them to me at whocentury@gmail.com, or message me on Twitter, or leave a comment on our webpage. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. Come on back and listen in.